Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So a few days ago, we were where we left off was with partway through the Madhupindaka Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya number 18, the Honey Ball, and had read through some of the key phrases in it, and also read some comments from Ajahn Jeff from his book Skill in Questions regarding. Papancha. And so where we pick up is about halfway through, maybe a little more than halfway through the sutta. So I'll finish, maybe I'll just refresh our memories with one of the phrases, and then we'll finish up the sutta and a little bit more of a commentary on that as well from Venerable Analio Satipatthana. So one of the key paragraphs that we spent a fair amount of time talking about was this one, and then I'll read from this and then go on for the rest of the sutta, which isn't very much. Dependent on the eye and forms, eye consciousness arises. The meeting of the three is contact. With contact as condition, there is feeling. What one feels, that one perceives. What one perceives, that one thinks about. What one thinks about, that one mentally proliferates. With what one has mentally proliferated as the source, perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation beset a man with respect to past, future, and present forms cognizable through the eye. Dependent on the ear and sounds, dependent on the nose and odors, dependent on the tongue and flavors, dependent on the body and tangibles, dependent on the mind and mind objects, mind consciousness arises. The meeting of the three is contact. With contact as condition, there is feeling. What one feels, that one perceives. What one perceives, that one thinks about. What one thinks about, that one mentally proliferates. With what one has mentally proliferated as the source, perceptions and notions born of the mental proliferation beset a man with respect to past, future, and present mind objects, cognizable through the mind. So I don't think one thing that we didn't really point out, but is maybe obvious, is that at the beginning of this little bit of a sequence with eye and form and eye consciousness, contact, feeling. Obviously, that's that's similar to the steps in dependent origination that comes from that. And this where it branches off is when at the level of feeling, rather than going straight on to craving, clinging, becoming, dukkha, and birth, death, etc. It kind of takes a little side branch through the mental, proliferating mental process, so that after the level of feeling, then that sets the stage for an association with certain perceptions. You know, that's all happening at the same time anyway. But this is sort of a little side loop about how the proliferation, about how perceptions can lead to thinking and to more proliferation, which then, of course, will lead to more perceptions and associated feelings with those perceptions. And particularly if it's something that's, say, emotionally charged, then the whole loop just kind of winds up in this positive feedback cycle, like holding a microphone too close to the recorder and just kind of start screaming. And you can see how all of those things that can just build up on each other and also kind of feed back into the loop of suffering, so that you're just really increasing the whole cycle of dukkha with the proliferative process. When there is the I, a form, and I consciousness, it is possible to point out the manifestation of contact. When there is the manifestation of contact, it is possible to point out the manifestation of feeling. When there is the manifestation of feeling, it is possible to point out the manifestation of perception. When there is the manifestation of perception, it is possible to point out the manifestation of thinking. When there is the manifestation of thinking, it is possible to point out the manifestation of besetment by perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation. And the same through ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind. And that was a bit of a confusing paragraph to me, because it doesn't sound like on the surface that it's a whole lot different from what was just said, but this introduction of the word manifestation. And there's Bhikkhu Bodhi had a footnote about it that I didn't think was particularly illuminating either, but I'll read it. The Pali idiom pasapanyating panyapesati, in which the verb takes an object derived from itself, is difficult. Nyanamoli originally rendered it that one will describe a description of contact. And then, quote, to point out a manifestation, which was Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation, is less literal, but it should do justice to the meaning without jeopardizing intelligibility. Commentaries says that this passage is intended to show the entire round of existence, vata, by way of the 12 sense bases. You know, I don't know, it all seemed kind of confusing to me, and that was an attempt to not make it less confusing, but it didn't help me. I looked up Ajahn Jeff's translation, and instead of the word manifestation, he used delineation, which didn't help any either. So, I don't know if you want to had any. Delineation. Right. Which isn't.
Delineation. Establishing, you know, I mean, sort of kind of establishing a criteria for.
Right. Yeah, I could sort of understand it, but it just didn't seem. I wasn't sure if there was some kind of special point that was supposed to be being made, and it didn't. I just couldn't. Didn't dawn on me. Got some ideas.
I pondered. You know, I definitely thought about the same thing, and it's subtle. But one thing, there's a subtle difference between Bhikkhu Nyanamoli's original translation and Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation. In that, if you know, when there, and I can't, I'll try to remember that, when there is, Nyanamoli's translation is, when there is an I and forms, it is possible that one will delineate I consciousness. Whereas, and that one there may, the thing is, if one takes the one as referring to the subject operating, that's different than what Bhikkhu Bodhi is saying, because if you say it is possible to point out a manifestation of, that takes the one pointing to some third party and makes it seem as if the process is inevitable. Whereas if the one is the subject here, then yes, it's possible that I could delineate a delineation, but I've got a choice. I don't have to. And that's a fairly substantial difference. So that was what I thought. Maybe that and again, the Pali, I don't know Pali grammar, and it does sound tangled.
Okay, sounds better than what I've come up with here before for my own self.
Okay, ready to move on? Okay. when there is no I, no form, and no I consciousness, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of contact. When there is no manifestation of contact, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of feeling. When there is no manifestation of feeling, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of perception. When there is no manifestation of perception, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of thinking. When there is no manifestation of thinking, it is impossible to point out the manifestation of besetment by perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation. So just the opposite. When there isn't this process occurring, then the whole proliferative process breaks down, just as in the cycle of dependent cessation. Yeah.
And it struck me too is that one thing that's, I think, very, very subtle with Dityasamuppada, and that's, I prefer Ajahn Jeff's translation of that phrase as dependent co-arising, right. Samuppada. So this, with when it's normally done with, with the arising of such, there is such, you can get a linear and time interpretation of it. Mm-hmm. But I think there's a number of places, and this is one of them, where it's made subtly clear that it's not like, contact rises, right. And then after that, feeling arises.
Right.
And then after that, perception arises. It's like they all come up together.
Mm-hmm.
And so, one is sort of maybe, I don't know, to say deeper in the sequence than the others. Like ignorance is the deepest of them all, but it's not like, there doesn't have to be a past. There doesn't have to be a passage of time, even though sometimes there is with these things.
Right.
But it's just that phraseology really makes sort of clear that it does. It's not. It's not time.
It's not time bound. Yeah.
Yeah, it's not time bound.
Yeah, and the same with, of course, the not just the. Paticca Samuppada, but this also side loop as well is a very instantaneous kind of occurrence. Okay. And then that same sequence with all the other sense bases. Friends, when the Blessed One rose from his seat and went into his dwelling after giving a summary in brief without expounding the detailed meaning, that is, bhikkhu, as to the source through which perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation beset a man, if nothing is found there to delight in, welcome, and hold to, this is the end of the underlying tendency to lust, of the underlying tendency to aversion, of the underlying tendency to views, of the underlying tendency to doubt, of the underlying tendency to conceit, of the underlying tendency to desire for being, of the underlying tendency to ignorance. This is the end of resorting to rods and weapons of quarrels, brawls, disputes, recrimination, malicious words, and false speech. Here these even unwholesome states cease without remainder. I understand the detailed meaning of the summary to be thus. Now, friends, if you wish, go to the Blessed One and ask him about the meaning of this. As the Blessed One explains it to you, so you should remember it. Then the bhikkhus, having delighted and rejoiced in the venerable Mahakachana's words, rose from their seats and went to the Blessed One. After paying homage to him, they sat down at one side and told the Blessed One all that had taken place after he had left, adding, "Then, venerable sir, we went to the venerable Mahakachana and asked him about the meaning. The venerable Mahakachana expounded the meaning to us with these terms, statements, and praises." The Buddha responds, "Mahakachana is wise, bhikkhus. Mahakachana has great wisdom. If you had asked me the meaning of this, I would have explained it to you in the same way that Mahakachana has explained it. Such is the meaning of this, and so you should remember it." When this was said, the Venerable Ananda said to the Blessed One, "Venerable Sir, just as if a man exhausted by hunger and weakness came upon a honey ball, wherever he would taste it, he would find a sweet, delectable flavor. So too, Venerable Sir, any able-minded bhikkhu, wherever he might scrutinize with wisdom the meaning of this discourse on the Dhamma, would find satisfaction and confidence of mind. Venerable Sir, what is the name of this discourse on the Dhamma?" As to that, Ananda, you may remember this discourse on the Dhamma as the Honeyball Discourse. That is what the Blessed One said, and the Venerable Ananda was satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So, yeah, revisited the Buddha's original statement that Mahakachana expounded on. Basically, if nothing is found there to delight in, as to the source through which these perceptions and notions are born of mental proliferation or are born, if nothing is found there in that process, at the source, meaning like at the level of feeling before it starts to contact feeling, any of those before it starts to blossom into the papancha process, then that kind of cuts off the tendency to ignite the underlying tendencies to take a hold and proliferate with the tendencies kind of underneath feeding the whole process. So cut it before it starts happening. Any questions on that before I read a few comments on that from Venerable Nalio? Yeah.
One of the observations I had was that it sounded like the description of the causal sequence, the co-arising sequence, after the non-proliferation or the objectification step. Like, for example, it referred to forms that will give rise to further I forgot what the words were, but the sacramentation around the eye level. And my experience with proliferation is that it seems to other sense bases. In other words, if something arises from the eye, proliferative process seems to not just be limited to the eye faculty. It can, you know, ear, body, or mind faculty. And I was wondering.
Well, usually, at least as I conceive of this, as I proliferate on this, it tends to, once it gets into the cycle of proliferation, then you're kind of, I find myself anyway, much more on the mental level, you know, and it's sort of like, the process is happening for me anyway on the level of the mental, you know, the papancha is happening. It gives rise, you know, that's a mental process of thinking, vitaka, that's happening, and expounding on that and cycling on that with, say, a certain negative feeling associated with that intellectual thought, with that thought in the mind. And that negative feeling then feeds other perceptions, memories, projections. And so it's all happening kind of like on a feeling, perception, thinking level. And it's sort of like other physical sense bases, you know, would be probably more in the realm of like new or different input. But to me, the cycle is happening at the level of mano, of the intellect, mind. Anybody else has any other thoughts on that?
Well, it's also it's collecting information from past sounds and sights and contact with the senses, collecting it from the past, proliferating it, it's a jumble.
If it were a visual thing or a hearing thing, you know, go and you experience that again, you know, you're just that much more primed to jump into the whole thing very quickly too. You know. Okay.
I think that's where that understanding the dependent core arising has. Both a synchronic process as well as diachronic. It's really important. You know, that time is functioning not just in a linear way, but in a associate with and encompassing. It'll take anything. Give me something to proliferate about. It's all at once.
Okay. Okay. A passage or two from Venerable Anālayo Satipatthana, page 222, section called The Perceptual Process. The conditioned character of the perceptual process is a central aspect of the Buddha's analysis of experience. According to the Madhupindika Sutta, the conditional sequence of the average perceptual process leads from contact via feeling and cognition, he uses the word cognition for sanya instead of perception, to thought, which can in turn stimulate conceptual proliferation, papancha. Such conceptual proliferations tend to give rise to further concoctions of proliferations and cognitions, papancha sanya sankha, which lead from the originally perceived sense data to all kinds of associations concerning past, present, and future. The Pali verb forms employed in this passage from the Madhupindika Sutta indicate that the last stage of this perceptual process is an event of which one is the passive experiencer. Once the conditioned sequence of the perceptual process has reached the stage of conceptual proliferation, one becomes, as it were, a victim of one's own associations and thoughts. The thought process proliferates, weaving a net built from thoughts, projections, and associations of which the quote-unquote thinker has become almost a helpless prey. I thought that was a very useful paragraph. Yep. You're just at the mercy of this thing going on in your head.
Yeah. Oh. Also, he illustrates the same thing about like giving the example of a magician who's like summoned a tiger who then proceeds to eat the magician.
Yeah. Absolutely. The crucial stage in this sequence, where the subjective bias can set in and distort the perceptual process, occurs with the initial appraisal of feeling, vedana, and cognition, sanya. Initial distortions of the sense data arising at this stage will receive further reinforcement by thinking and by conceptual proliferation. Once the stage of conceptual proliferation is reached, the course is set. The proliferations are projected back onto the sense data, and the mind continues proliferating by interpreting experience in line with the original biased cognition. The stages of cognition and initial conceptual reaction are therefore decisive aspects of this condition sequence. The perceptual sequence described in the Madhupindika Sutta occurs in an elucidation of a short statement made by the Buddha in which he related his teaching to the dispelling of various latent types of cognitions, latent anusetti types of cognitions, sanya, and to overcoming the, quote, anusaya latent tendencies that can come into operation during the process of perception. So, skip a few points here and move to a way to avoid the operation of the influxes, and that's the way he translates asava instead of outflows or kankers or many of the other ones. He uses influxes. A way to avoid the operation of the influxes, underlying tendencies and fetters, and thereby the arising of unwholesome states of mind and reactions at any sense door, is the practice of sense restraint, indriya sanwara. The method of sense restraint is mainly based on sati, whose presence exerts a restraining influence on the reactions and proliferations that otherwise tend to occur during the perceptual process. As the discourses point out, sense restraint causes the arising of joy and happiness, which in turn form the basis for concentration and insight. Indeed, living with full awareness in the present moment, free from sensual distraction, can give rise to an exquisite sense of delight. This paragraph comes up as a way of saying, well, what can we do about this whole thing? So he's just offering, as an initial practice, this sense restraint. Such cultivation of mindfulness of the sense doors does not imply that one is simply to avoid sense impressions. As the Buddha pointed out in the Indriya Bhavana Sutta, if simply avoiding seeing and hearing were in itself conducive to realization, blind and deaf people would be accomplished practitioners. Instead, the instrument for sense restraint enjoins the practitioner not to dwell on the sign, nimitta, or secondary characteristics, anuvyanjana, of sense objects, in order to avoid the flowing in of detrimental influences. In the present context, sign refers to the distinguishing feature by which one recognizes or remembers something. In regard to the process of perception, this sign is related to the first evaluation of the raw sense data, because of which the object appears to be, for example, beautiful, subha nimitta, or irritating, patiga nimitta, which then usually leads to subsequent evaluations and mental reactions. The instruction to bring restraint to bear on the secondary characteristics would correspond to further associations in the perceptual process, which elaborate in detail the initial biased cognition. The tendency to biased and affective reactions is rooted in the stage of sign-making, when the first barely conscious evaluations that might underlie cognition can arise. In the context of the Satipatthana Sutta's injunction to contemplate the causes related to the arising of a fetter, this stage of sign-making is especially relevant. In this stage, therefore, and the possibilities that it is in... Oh, okay, I'll just leave that there. That's the end. He goes on to quite some detail about the whole cognitive training process. So basically just making the point that, one place to prevent the whole proliferative process from going is through being very careful with where your mind is going in terms of sensory stimulation, and that includes the mind, the ideas, not just the five physical senses, so that the restraint aspect being not attending in an unskillful way, not applying inappropriate attention to those aspects of an object that are either, say, enticing or repelling, in such a way, not attending to those particular features of an object in such a way that it leads to desire, lust, aversion as ways of supporting the whole proliferative process. Skillful using appropriate attention in the way that you observe data coming into the mind through the sense bases, including intellect and ideas. And I think another way also is just to really, right from the beginning, as has been pointed out, working with and recognizing all perceptions just as perceptions in and of themselves. Working as much as possible with the thinking process, the perceiving process, the ideas process, as those are just objects of mind. Those are just objects without any kind of inherent self-relationship. They're not me, they're not mine, they're not who I am. And with that backing off of identification from these processes, the grip is loosened. So, any other thoughts or comments, questions?
Actually, a question about understanding what the primary and the secondary qualities of something are. Talking about the talking about the sign that's sort of present in the sensory data that sort of calls out that this object is what it is, and then sort of where, what is, I'm kind of curious of what some examples would be like, because I'm just kind of looking at the floor and the wood, and I'm wondering, would the wood grain itself be sort of the initial sort of primary sort of identifier that this is, that this is wood, and then, you know, secondary qualities, you know, if there were any thoughts about, you know, what kind of wood it was, or, you know, and onward, you know, do I like this kind of wood, and onward and onward. Would that be sort of...
To some extent, that's my...
It's a little confusing. It's been a little confusing to me, like, what's the difference between signs and features, you know, in the translation too. But that, and I think what Venerable Nalyo was saying leads to that, that, you know, on a, say, on a more... graphic description, or say, you know, like attraction to somebody, you know, like sensual attraction. You see something that seems, the initial take is something that seems attractive, like, you know, like in the case of that suitor of Suba the nun, you know, her, it was her eyes that that he was attracted to. So that's like the initial sign is some, say, physical feature that brings up, you know, a sense of delight. And then it's that further, like, moving into and examining, you know, oh, nice eyes, nice face, nice, you know, nice person, nice, you know, that kind of elaborates, proliferates, and moves into it. But I've never been absolutely clear if that's exactly what the difference between signs and features is. If anybody else has any thoughts on that?
I mean, I think that's my understanding. The thing, I think the thing to note is that that initial sign is just, yeah, something strikes you as either positive or negative. And then part of the habit of our distorted thinking is that as soon as we pick that up, and then we start looking for things that reinforce our perception, and we will... preferentially, by far, perceive the things that support that initial perception. So I can, you know, so, gosh, I've done it so many times. For some reason, I will take a position in an argument, and even though I had no particular commitment to that, once I take it, I will then figure out all the reasons to support it, even though, you know what? It's
even though you could easily be convinced that it wasn't a great one to start with.
Yeah, exactly. And I could have just as easily flipped to the other perspective. And you have no idea why that you initially did it, but you commit to it, and
yeah, it's the underlying tendency to whatever that kind of rises, picks up, and grabs it. You know, and like in the case of sensual attraction, it's sensual desire. You know, it's like that's what comes and says, "Oh, I'm interested. I'm going to attend to this in a way that, you know, really, you know, satisfies or increases or plays on that sensual desire." You know, so that's where inappropriate attention comes. It just kind of, it's there, you know, underlying tendency, and it rises up and it just goes right out to, you know, get involved with the object and make it even more than it really is, just to keep it going. Yeah, John.
One way I've interpreted this sort of sign features is like, I don't know, like you're eating something, and you know, if you pay attention to the taste or the textures, you know, have certain features to it, but then, like, there'll be like this sort of, once like there's a certain association made, then there's a sign of, oh, this is like, you know, like this in the past, like delicious or homey or whatever. And it's kind of, it feels mental. It doesn't feel like, I don't know, that's the way I describe it, just my experience. It feels mental, that sign feels mental, as opposed to the actual taste or the textures or smells.
Yeah, they feed back on each other and support each other, the physical and the mental. Yeah, it's a very powerful process that we all find ourselves involved with. It's kind of...
And it also sifts out conveniently neglects other things.
Right. It's very specialized.
I was listening to Ajahn's, exactly that, Ajahn Sucitta. teaching forestry future retreat. So he says you've got 30 meditators in the room, but you single out one particular meditator, and then you don't notice like his or her, you know, clothes, the way they walk, what they eat. It's just like, if that man sniffs again, I'm going to go over and slug him. It's like, so you've like spotlighted this particular person, but in that you've completely neglected every single
thing. Everything else.
Yeah. So it's like you have a search engine out, which is the underlying tendency of your aversion, just like wants to hone it.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. Completely ignoring everything else. It's, you know, I think that's probably one of the reasons why the Buddha said that even with no internal factor more supportive to realization of the teachings than appropriate attention. You know, how to learn how to appropriately attend to sense data. Okay, if that's it.